From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the books of 2019. It was a banner year for books about how Americans see the world and how the world views America. With 2019 drawing to an end, we look back at three of the books we featured here on First Person, beginning with a memoir written by Jason Rezaian. Rezaian was a Washington Post correspondent in Iran when he was arrested in 2014 and charged with espionage. He spent more than 18 months in prison before being released. I had the chance to talk to Rezaian back in January. A few days before July 22nd, 2014, your email's hacked.
Yeah.
Or there's a phishing scam. What happened?
So I received an email from what looked to be the email address of a friend of mine, someone who I worked with from time to time in Iran. And I, you know, in retrospect, realized that I clicked on a link that I wasn't supposed to. And via that, the IRGC agency who...
Explain what the IRGC is.
The Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps, who are the, you know, kind of maybe the main power in Iran right now, but, you know, a competing power center with the executive branch, with Rouhani's government. You know, these are people who have their own beliefs and ideals, and their main mandate is to protect the system at all costs, mm-hmm. right? And they're the ones that have been generally responsible for the arrest and detention of dual nationals, foreign nationals, hostages that have been taken and leveraged, like me.
Even in times of ostensible reform and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would argue that they have ramped those up to defuse or undercut any attempts. I don't know if reform is the right word, but of opening up to the rest of the world. So, you know, they had accessed our emails and also our social media accounts. And so that was a day or so before we were arrested. And it was cause for concern. But I went to the authorities in Tehran who oversee press relations, who have a very close relationship with the Ministry of Intelligence, who are the traditionally the force that oversees journalists, who happened to be at great odds with the intelligence force that ended up arresting my wife and I. And I asked them, you know, very directly, I said, you know, this happened to us and we've seen a couple of other things that make us feel as though we've been followed around the city the last couple of days. Are we being investigated? Are we being trailed? Is there something that, you know, that we have done to raise the ire or skepticism of the authorities? And it may sound sort of naive on the surface, but, you know, after 5 years of dealing with this agency on a near daily basis, there's a rapport that gets built up. And, you know, if there is a problem, they are the organization that would tell you, hey, you know, you can't work anymore. You crossed the line here. You're being suspended from the ability to practice journalism. You should leave the country. We can't protect you. We can't guarantee your safety.
You've been telling stories, and you mentioned culture, but also food.
I've been telling all kinds of stories. I mean, I've been writing about food, people, sports, politics, environmental crises, and the situation of women. I was doing my job as a journalist. And that agency came back to me and said, Jason, there's absolutely nothing wrong with what you're doing. Nobody's investigating you for anything. Everything's fine. And literally, the day that we were arrested, we were given one-year extensions of our press credentials.
Take us to July 22nd, 2014. What happened?
It was a strange day. I got a phone call from my wife. I was out reporting on a story. She and I were set to travel to the U.S. just a few days later. We were going to come home for a couple of months. And I got a frantic call from her that, you know, I've received this email, which is essentially a blackmail-type email. Rush home, please. You know, I don't know what's going on. I came home as fast as I could, got in touch with the friend of ours who helps us with our IT needs. He came and said, you know, you've been hacked and let's change your passwords and let's set up two-step verification so this doesn't happen again and all that. We did all of that. You know, I calmed down, tried to calm my wife down. We were getting ready to go to a surprise birthday party for my mother-in-law, and we were leaving the building to get in a car that we had called to come and pick us up. And when the elevator door, we lived in a high-rise apartment building, when the elevator door opened, there were several men standing in front of the door, one of them with a gun pointed at me. They entered the elevator and took us back up to our apartment, ransacked the place, and took us to prison.
And that night, you're taken to prison. How much longer are you with your wife?
We were together in the van ride over. We were blindfolded, and I was handcuffed. We weren't allowed to talk. We got to the prison, and then we were separated. We had a very brief encounter in an initial interrogation session that happened. I was blindfolded. She could obviously see me. She asked me what was going on. Why were we there? When is this going to end? I tried to calm her, but imagine yourself in a room with people accusing you of being a CIA station chief, blindfolded. Your wife frantically asking you what's happening. And then she was whisked away, and I didn't see or hear anything from her for the next 35 days.
Where were you taken?
Solitary confinement.
And how long were you there?
I was in solitary for 49 days, and she was in prison for 72 nights and spent all of them in solitary.
What was your cell like?
It was tiny. It was, nobody's here with us, but much smaller than the studio that we're in right now. I could lie down in one direction and not the other. I think it was about 4.5 by 8.5 feet. I had a tiny little hole in the ground as a toilet. It was also a nice breeding ground for roaches and other things. And a very small sink. The ceilings were about 10 feet tall, and that was it. I mean, you know, there's no bed, there's no furniture. There's windows very high up on the wall, close to the ceiling with bars over them that I couldn't see out, but I could, you know, make out whether it was night or day. And a big steel door that would open a couple of times a day, slats in the bottom of it for food to come in, and a little tiny window that guards could open and yell orders at you. Suffice it to say, I mean, solitary confinement is not designed to be nice.
Were you interrogated during that time?
Yeah. And, you know, as time went on, you kind of look forward to interrogations because this becomes your only shot of human contact. So it was probably, you know, the most personally trying period of my life. But when you come out of solitary, the mental scars of that don't go away. I mean, I'm still afraid of confined places. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. There's no justification for the use of long-term solitary confinement. I don't care what government's doing it. I'm vehemently opposed to the practice, and I think everybody should be.
How did you keep yourself sane while you were there?
I paced, you know, and it wasn't a lot of steps between one side of the cell to the other. I spent a lot of time, you know, replaying episodes and periods in my life, making plans, you know, thinking about all the things that I would try to make right in my life, apologize for certain things that I felt guilty about. I mean, anything. You just do anything, but, you know, you don't want your mind to creep towards, what if I never get out of here? What are they doing to my wife? Mm-hmm. Will I ever see her again? Will I ever see my mother again? You know, you do whatever you can to stay away from those thoughts. And those thoughts are there with you all the time. I mean, they live with you. But you work hard to fill your mind with other stuff.
When you were in interrogation, what were they accusing you of?
In practice, they were accusing me of being a journalist. But, you know, in their terminology, they were accusing me of spying for the U.S.
When did you first see your wife again?
On the 35th day after an interrogation session, my lead interrogator told me, you're going to see your wife. And I didn't believe him. And, you know, very abruptly, they brought her into the room and she was blindfolded and she didn't know that she was coming to see me, obviously. I think it was one of the best moments of my life, you know, at the same time, one of the hardest, and it only lasted a couple of minutes. But the knowledge that, you know, she was still alive and in relatively good shape, and so was I. They didn't allow us to talk to each other.
Did they let you touch?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, initially, no. But, you know, my wife is pretty persistent. And she came and gave me a big hug and, you know, made me show my profile, which was a shadow of what it had been before, which I think she was both happy about and horrified by. It was hard, but in that situation, you're always looking for any reason to be hopeful. And in 35 days of being told that I was probably never going to see the outside again, that, you know, it had been reported that I was dead, that nobody cared, that I may never see my wife again, that it was very highly likely that I'd be executed. You know, this was the first little piece of thing that I had to hope on.
That was Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post. His book is titled Prisoner, My 544 Days in Iranian Prison, Solitary Confinement, A Sham Trial, High Stakes Diplomacy, and the Extraordinary Efforts It Took to Get Me Out. Next, we'll hear from George Packer. His book focuses on the late U.S. diplomat Richard Holbrooke, whose life spanned the period of American dominance in the world. The sheer force of Holbrooke's personality helped bring about the Dayton Accords, which put an end to the Bosnian War in the 1990s. But as Packer argues, Holbrooke embodied America's best and worst impulses, and the two were often inseparable. Packer was interviewed in May by foreign policy columnist Stephen Walt. He's a professor of international affairs at Harvard University.
So let's go back a little bit. So he begins his career in Vietnam, in rural affairs, at a remarkably young age. You know, I keep thinking, you know, what was I doing at 22, 23? And there he is off, you know, providing aid as part of what we would now call nation building.
He was doing nation building. He was doing civilian counterinsurgency. He was the top American civilian in this very hot province with the Viet Cong all around, and he was 22 years old.
Yeah. He's quickly spotted as a very able, very capable young guy. What are the lessons he took from Vietnam? Because in a sense, they shape much of the rest of his career.
Yeah, the book is organized around three wars, which each gets a very long section: Vietnam, Bosnia, Afghanistan. And really, Vietnam was the key to everything. He learned right away, because he had a really clear and unafraid intelligence, that we were losing, that the military reports going to Saigon and from Saigon to Washington were misleading, if not outright false, that that was costing us, because if the assessments are wrong, they're leading to wrong strategies and tactics. He realized the tactics were costing us the war, because we were coming into these hamlets with helicopter gunships and overwhelming firepower and shooting at anyone on the ground who was moving, regardless of whether they were Viet Cong or, I mean, by now we know all this from watching Apocalypse Now and Platoon, but this was 1963. We were the good guys. We were coming in to save a brave people who only wanted to be left alone from this communist aggression coming from the North. That was a nearly universal view of Vietnam at that point, including among the journalists who became the war's biggest critics. So to be totally against this war would have made Holbrooke an absolute freak. He wasn't. But what he saw was how badly it was being fought and how wrongly. He wanted a more intelligent war. He wanted a war of restraint and of nation building and of hearts and minds, and that was what his job was in the Mekong Delta.
And in what sense does then that shape the worldview going forward, you know, sort of the rest of his career?
It's complicated, because for some Americans, that was the end of their faith in counterinsurgency and really in America's ability to work its will in some messy foreign war. That's not the lesson Holbrooke took. He became a skeptic of the military and of the militarization of foreign policy. He saw the diplomats being pushed aside by Westmoreland and the generals. And he didn't like that. He wanted to be
right.
the center of the policy. And that became a lasting lesson, as well as that lesson about needing to be on the ground in order to see the truth and not believe the reports. But he did not take the lesson that we should stay out. He took him 4 years to realize we can't win. He had to go back to the United States and see that the war was tearing up the country and we would not have public support long enough to win, and Hanoi would outlast us. And that's when he learned the next lesson, which is you've got to talk to the enemy. You cannot shoot your way to victory. You have to talk. And he became part of the Paris peace talks under Averell Harriman, which went nowhere. And that was pretty much the end of his years working on Vietnam. But I would say he moved on, as always, without being devastated by this experience. Other people were, but he continued to believe in himself and in America as the center of everything. It's just that we need to be careful and prudent and skeptical of too much happy talk, but we can't step aside. He never believed that.
So another feature of this book is there's a portrait of the, let's call it the foreign policy elite or the foreign policy establishment throughout the book. He's obviously a member of it, has a delicate relationship, maybe to put it politely, with many of them. But it's not a very flattering picture. There are a lot of small, very, I think, piercing characterizations of key figures. In a sense, nobody comes off well. Zbigniew Brzezinski, not Anthony Lake, ultimately.
I would say Lake comes off as a more decent human being than Richard Holbrooke, and often the victim of Richard Holbrooke's aggressive tactics. He has his own flaws and his own policy mistakes that he has to answer to history for. Bosnia. He wanted to get us involved, but he had to work for Bill Clinton, who wanted nothing to do with it, and so Lake couldn't get us involved. But you're right that the portraits are pretty they're unvarnished. And
it's worse than that. I mean, you're right, and it's a great sense. The nation's vital business is carried out amid humiliating pettiness. And there's an awful lot of that. But you also have a variety of, let's just say, you know, jabs at almost everyone who comes across the page, right? Were there people in the writing of the book who rose in your estimation? You came away feeling better about them than you had when you started.
I think what this shows is how there's a layer of falseness over most writing about powerful people in government, certainly in their own writing. One thing I learned in reading some of the memoirs of the characters in this book is just not to trust them. Obviously, we shouldn't, but it's not just that they put themselves at the center of things and in a better light. It's that they can't really reveal who they are, because when you get to the top, you don't get there simply by being a good public servant. That's part of it. But ambition is not a pretty thing. It is a frightening force, especially when you see it absolutely unchained in someone like Holbrooke. But they're all ambitious. And government does something to them. And it's not just because they're petty. It's because the stakes are incredibly high. America has all this power. They're scrambling for a limited number of positions. Their policy arguments become bitterly personal. And in fact, I feel like foreign policy making is mainly about human character. I mean, they don't really know what they're doing. They don't have enough information about the rest of the world to make absolutely objective, detached, clinical decisions. It's biases, it's ideologies, it's impulses, it's ambitions, it's politics. I think foreign policy more than domestic policy is driven just by the character of the people involved. And government can destroy you. I mean, many people in this book are, if not absolutely destroyed, they're at least really damaged by it. It gives me some sympathy for them, because I think they're not bad people. It's that government is an arena that brings this out. And I think most accounts of it don't portray it accurately. I think there's a gloss that I wanted to strip off to show what it's really like.
So maybe a more pointed way of asking this is, you know, one way of reading the book is to say, again, a man with great strengths, great weaknesses. Sort of, do you have to be an insufferable egomaniac driven in this way to succeed? Is the nature of the task.
You don't. And that was one review suggested that, and I think it was wrong because Holbrooke, in him, these two qualities are inseparable. His idealism and his egotism, wrapped up in ambition, were two parts of the same whole. And if you tried to fix him, you would destroy him. You'd make him incapable. But that doesn't mean everyone has to be Richard Holbrooke. And there are many successful policymakers, politicians, who are not Richard Holbrooke. I mean, Barack Obama is the opposite of Richard Holbrooke in many ways. And he's a historic figure. So, no, I would not go. It's not that Hobbesian. But in the wake of Holbrooke, it seems like it just churns up a lot of blood and bile. And it may also make the other animals in the forest a little wilder themselves.
That was George Packer, a staff writer at The Atlantic. His book is titled Our Man, Richard Holbrooke and the End of the American Century. Finally, let's turn to my interview with journalist Laura Weidsman-Yose. She followed the lives of several undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children. I spoke to her in July.
I was looking for this story. Kind of the end of the year was a slow period at work. I was at the AP, and I got this invitation to go hear about these young people who are walking from Miami to Washington in the middle of winter. It was a little crazy, but it was interesting. So I went there. And I heard these four young people speak, Felipe Salsa Rodriguez, Isabel Salsa Rodriguez, Gabby Pacheco, and Carlos Roa. And there's just this thing about them, this determination, this innocence, and this bravado, this swagger, all wrapped together that was incredibly compelling. And they wanted to call attention to the fact that they had no status in the U.S. They had grown up here. Some of them were very good students. And they were just asking to have some reprieve from getting deported, which, of course, is what ended up happening. They did get temporary protections. But at that time, the, you know, comprehensive immigration reform movement was just dead in the water. They had tried a number of times. And there was sort of this loss of direction. What were we going to do? And these young people just galvanized the country when they walked, and they didn't even have jackets. It was cold. They had to stop and get off their walk and buy jackets because north of Miami, it's really cold. And a few months later, by the end of the year, they had the first vote for the DREAM Act, and it passed in the House under then-Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and it failed by 5 votes in the Senate. But that told me there was something going on, and I thought I'd got to document this for posterity.
On that very first march that you described from Miami to D.C., did you participate on the march with them?
No, so I went, it was New Year's Day, I got up early and just walked with them, you know, that first bit, and then followed them and wrote about it. And by the time they reached Washington in April, they had generated headlines around the world.
What did it feel like in that crowd? What was that crowd like?
There was just this tremendous energy and hope and idealism that, but also desperation, because you don't march, I don't know, 1,300 miles if you take detours, because I did a bunch of detours. You don't march like that if you have any other option. I mean, it was exhausting. They had disgusting blisters on their feet and backs were thrown out. They were sleeping in, you know, the basements or wherever they could. So there was a desperation that I didn't see after that for a long time amid, you know, for many of them once they began to have a voice. And now, you know, now we're starting to see it again.
One of the things about undocumented immigrants in general, let alone children, is that there is this fear of exposure. Was there reticence on their part? How did you get access?
It was really hard. On the one hand, I had been covering immigration for more than a decade, so I knew a lot of people, and I had built up a body of work, and I was trusted as a journalist. But certainly, when I first started, there was no protection. People were very scared, and so it was a lot of discussion. The people I ended up choosing were all people who, by the time I started writing the really researching and writing the book in 2013 and 14, whose lives had been in the public sphere already. And so I wasn't worried that I was outing them and thus setting them up for being targets. And so I had to build a lot of trust. There were a lot of people who said no. There were a lot of people who felt that they so represented major organizations that they didn't want to delve into their personal lives. I wanted people who, you know, really could tell the real story, you know, the mistakes, the truths, the doubts, all of that, not just sort of the talking points.
Who was the first person that you started to follow?
I had covered the story of Marie Gonzalez, who is in the middle of the country in Jefferson City, Missouri, when her case was first unfolding in 2005.
So Marie's story is really interesting because her father worked for the governor's office, which means he was really integrated into a very mainstream system, but was undocumented.
Right. And someone outed him. He was working for the governor. He worked in the mailroom. And actually, he'd been lauded as a hero because right after 9/11, and there was the anthrax scare, they had gotten a bunch of envelopes with white powder, and he had found it, and it was a huge thing. And so he was lauded as sort of a hero. But some of that attention, I think, someone called the governor's office and outed him as being undocumented. And then not only that, I think then leaked it to the press. So the governor's office had to take action. So he was fired and the family was put into deportation hearings. And this was really significant because she was one of the first undocumented youths to speak out publicly with their case and have organizations take up our case. And the reason why, in some ways, she could speak out so forcefully and come to Washington and stand up and give her name is because she was already in deportation proceedings. There was sort of nothing to lose at that point.
How old was Marie when she came?
She was a toddler. She was very young. She doesn't remember her native country of Costa Rica at all.
And there's this sense around the children, around the dreamers themselves, that they're blameless, right? That becomes kind of a theme. But if the children are blameless, then someone is to blame. But the children actually really struggle with the idea of blaming their parents for this.
Right. It is true. They came as kids. They didn't make that choice. They've grown up here. On the other hand, it sort of begs the question of who's to blame. And Marie would talk about going to speak to Congress and just feeling this visceral nausea because she felt like she was throwing her parents under the bus. And I think that over time, as the youth movement has gained strength, they've really tried to reshape that narrative so that there's less talk of through no fault of their own because they no longer want to throw their parents under the bus in that same way, even as they are, you know, many are supporting a bill that would simply focus on them.
Marie does get deferred action on her own case, but her parents don't. And a lot of these families are divided. How did Marie handle that?
It was very hard. I mean, at 19, she's sort of orphaned in the United States. She goes to college, gets a scholarship, but she talks about living in people's basements. It was very isolating. And it was amazing because this community that really didn't even realize they had any undocumented immigrants amongst them and, you know, were pretty conservative in Missouri, they came to her aid and were incredibly supportive. And I think the people who knew her and saw her case started to rethink many issues that they had sort of assumed they understood. But it really affected her relationship with her family. And she didn't see her parents again for 5 years. And, you know, it really breaks those ties in many ways.
The question, I guess, then is it a win for her to get to stay?
I mean, I think that's a complicated question. She's now married. She's a U.S. citizen. She has two kids here. This is her home. So for her, it is a win, but it's a win that has always comes with a veil of pain for the separation that it created with her family and her parents.
Was there something unique about the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s that sort of coalesced this group?
I mean, one thing is people are staying longer. So instead of before our immigration laws became tougher and tougher in 96 toward 2000, people would cross the border back and forth, and so their families might stay. Mm-hmm. Now their families were coming to join them because you couldn't go back and forth, and so those kids are coming and staying. That's one thing. You then have this bigger group, but you also have the rise of social media. And so these kids have this outlet, have a source for getting their message out. They could take an iPhone and start filming, and they really did. And they kind of pioneered that in-your-face confrontation that then goes immediately to social media. And that's part of it. And then I think there's also, you know, a change in demographics. As there is a growth in immigrants in the United States, there's more of a recognition of others that are here and some of the challenges that they're facing, legal or not legal.
That was journalist Laura Weeds-Munoz. Her book is titled The Making of a Dream, How a Group of Young Undocumented Immigrants Helped Change What It Means to Be an American. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Anise Modi and Benjamin Soloway. Our editors, Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. Next week, we'll be looking at three of the documentary films we featured on First Person this year. There have been a number of excellent ones. Meanwhile, hit subscribe on that podcast app, check out our podcast list, and tell your friends. Come back next week. Thanks for listening.